All right. Welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Today we're diving into a super interesting area of labor law, specifically looking at the NLRB.
Yeah, the National Labor Relations Board.
The NLRB. And we're focusing on two really important cases for understanding kind of the power of administrative agencies.
Right.
And both of these cases, they actually have the same name, which is interesting. Leadham v. IBEW.
Yeah, two completely different cases.
Totally different. One from 1955-56, and the other one's from 1960.
Right.
So we're going to be unpacking those decisions, looking at how courts have sort of approached the NLRB's authority, where they've limited it, and where they've given it kind of broad discretion.
Right.
And to do this, we've been digging into some really interesting materials, actual NLRB decisions themselves.
Right.
And also some court analyses, you know, looking at how these cases have been interpreted over time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for you law students out there, this is going to be a masterclass in understanding the tension between, you know, sticking to the letter of the law versus allowing for some agency flexibility.
Yeah, absolutely. I think these two cases in particular highlight that tension really well. You have one case that's all about sticking to the letter of the law, and the other that's all about allowing the agency to sort of evolve and adapt to the times, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting study, and I think it's one that will be really helpful for anyone, you know, who wants to understand the power of agencies and how courts have you know, dealt with them over time.
Totally. So let's just jump right in. Let's start with the first Leadham case.
Mm-hmm.
This one from the mid-50s.
Right.
And this one really centers around a specific part of the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, Section 9H. Ah. And, you know, just to remind everyone, this section back then, it basically required union officers to swear under oath that they weren't members of the Communist Party.
Right. Which was a big deal back then. It was the height of the Red Scare.
Oh, yeah. Big time. McCarthyism and all that, you know, really fascinating historical context.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so in this particular case, a union officer did file this affidavit.
Right.
Saying, hey, I'm not a communist. but then the NLRB, they found out that this affidavit, it was actually fraudulent.
Yeah, which is, you know, not good.
No, not good at all. And so what they did was they decided to revoke the union's benefits under the NLRA.
Right.
You know, kind of as a penalty. And so this really raises the question, right? Like, what exactly can the NLRB do when something like this happens?
That's the big question, right? Like, what's the extent of their authority?
Totally. Yeah, like, was criminal prosecution under Section 9H? Like, was that the only way to deal with this?
Right.
Or could the NLRB also come in and impose, like, separate administrative penalties?
Mm-hmm. Like, do they have that kind of power?
Yeah. And so the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, they eventually weighed in on this.
Right.
And they actually held that those criminal sanctions, the ones specifically listed in Section 9H, those were the only remedy.
Right.
So the NLRB, you know, they couldn't do anything beyond that.
Right. Their hands were tied in the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think? Like, why did the court go that way?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. The court, you know, really looked at the legislative intent behind Section 9H, and they concluded that Congress, when they wrote that section, their main goal was to penalize the individual officers.
Okay.
Right? The ones who filed these false affidavits, not the unions themselves.
Gotcha.
So their focus was really on, you know, the individual misconduct.
Right.
And the other big thing was the court was really worried that if the NLRB could impose additional penalties, you know, like revoking the union's benefits,
right,
that would end up punishing the entire union membership for what one person did.
Oh, that's a good point. Right. And they saw that as, you know, kind of a drastic penalty.
Yeah.
That wasn't what Congress intended at all.
Right.
So they were really concerned about, you know, fairness and proportionality.
Totally. So, you know, for our listeners out there, especially the law students, what's the big takeaway here?
Well, I think the big thing is that it really shows how important it is to, you know, pay attention to the actual language of the law.
Right.
And when Congress has put a specific remedy in place,
right,
courts are going to be really hesitant to let agencies go beyond that.
Right. So in this case, the NLRB, their power was kind of limited.
Exactly. Right. They couldn't just do whatever they wanted. They had to follow what the statute said.
Okay. So that's a pretty clear example of, like, strict statutory interpretation.
Right? Absolutely.
The court's like, no, you gotta stick to the script.
You gotta stick to the script.
Okay, cool. So now let's switch gears a bit and talk about the second Leadham case.
Right.
The one from 1960. This one's pretty different.
Yeah.
It focuses on the NLRB's ability to create and change its own rules.
Yeah. This one's about the contract bar rule.
Yeah.
And that's a rule that basically prevents another union from trying to, you know, represent workers who are already covered by a collective bargaining agreement.
Right.
So it's all about, you know, maintaining some stability.
Right.
In the workplace.
Yeah, avoiding chaos.
Avoiding chaos, exactly.
So back in 1953, the NLRB had this rule where rivals couldn't challenge a contract for, like, its whole term.
Right.
But there was a five-year cap.
Right.
And in this specific case, a union, the IBEW, they'd managed to negotiate a three-year contract.
Right.
So they're, you know, feeling pretty good. Like, okay, we've got 3 years of peace here.
3 years of stability.
Yeah.
You know, they can focus on representing the workers and not worry about, you know, some other union coming in and trying to take over.
Exactly. Yeah. But then the NLRB decided to change things up in 1958. They decided to make this contract bar rule shorter.
Yeah.
Only 2 years.
Right.
And get this, they applied it retroactively.
Oh, yeah. And this is where things get interesting.
Yeah. So even though the IBEW had that three-year contract,
right,
this new rule meant that a rival union could actually start a challenge after just 2 years.
Right. Which totally messed up the IBEW's plan.
Yeah. Threw them for a loop.
Yeah.
So what happened then?
Well, because of this new shorter rule, a representation election was actually allowed to happen.
Right.
Like 10 months before the IBEW's contract was supposed to end.
Wow.
So, yeah, it really created a lot of uncertainty.
Big time.
And, you know, for the IBEW, it was a huge deal.
Yeah, I bet. So the big question here becomes, did the NLRB, you know, did they have the power to do this? Like, could they actually change the rules of the game like that?
Right. Like, could they just retroactively change the rule and undermine the agreement that the IBEW had negotiated in good faith?
Exactly, yeah. Was that fair? Was it even legal?
Right, that's the legal issue here.
Yeah. So the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, they ended up upholding the NLRB's authority to apply this rule retroactively.
Right.
So they were basically saying, yeah, the NLRB can do that.
Which is, you know, again, pretty different from the first Leadham case.
Huge contrast, right?
Yay.
So what was their logic this time around?
Well, the majority, they relied on this idea of a balancing test.
Go.
They said that, you know, the NLRB needs to have some flexibility to carry out the goals of the NLRA.
Okay.
And one of those big goals is, you know, making sure that employees have a free choice in who represents them.
Right, their bargaining representative.
Exactly. And in this case, the court thought that that need for flexibility, you know, it outweighed the IBEW's interest in having, like, a stable contract for the full 3 years.
So they were prioritizing, like, the workers' right to choose.
Right.
Over the union's reliance on the old rules.
Exactly.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. And they also said that, you know, we got to give the NLRB some deference. Like, they're the experts in labor relations, right? So we got to let them make these kinds of decisions, you know, about how to best balance things.
Okay. So they were giving, like, a lot of weight to the NLRB's expertise.
Exactly. And they were also saying that, you know, this flexibility is important because things change.
Right.
The labor landscape, it's constantly evolving.
Yeah.
So the NLRB needs to be able to adapt, you know, to new circumstances and new challenges.
Okay, I see. But wasn't everyone on board with this decision? I thought there were some concurring opinions that raised some interesting points.
Oh, absolutely. There were a couple of concurrences that are really worth looking at. Judge Miller, for example, he agreed with the outcome. You know, he agreed that the NLRB could change the rule.
Okay.
But he also pointed out that it was kind of unfair to unions like the IBEW.
Right.
You know, they had negotiated this contract in good faith, relying on the old rule.
Yeah.
And now suddenly the rules had changed. So he was basically saying, yeah, the NLRB might have the legal authority to do this.
Wait.
But it doesn't mean it's, you know, the right thing to do. It doesn't mean it's fair.
Totally. What about Judge Berger? Didn't he also have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, he did. And, you know, he went on to become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Oh, wow.
So his opinion carries a lot of weight. He was worried that this kind of retroactive rulemaking, it could create a lot of instability.
Okay.
You know, undermine the whole point of having contracts in the first place.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, he agreed that the NLRB had this responsibility, you know, to promote the goals of the NLRA.
Right.
And he also recognized that sometimes, you know, administrative efficiency requires some tough choices.
Yeah.
So he reluctantly agreed with the majority.
Okay, so it sounds like even though the court upheld the NLRB's decision, there were still some real concerns about how this retroactive rule change might affect things.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so now we've got these two lead-em cases.
Right.
One where the court was very strict.
Right.
Saying the NLRB couldn't do anything beyond what the statute explicitly said.
Right, right.
And then this other one where they gave the NLRB a lot more leeway to change its own rules.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big difference, isn't it?
It's a huge difference.
So how do we make sense of that? Like, why this difference in approach?
Well, I think the key is to look at the context of each case.
Okay.
In the first case, the 1955 one, it was about punishing someone for a very specific violation.
Right.
Filing a false affidavit.
Right.
And Congress had already said what the penalty should be.
Right.
Criminal prosecution.
Criminal prosecution.
So the court was basically saying, look, the NLRB can't just invent new punishments.
Right.
They have to follow what Congress said.
Okay, that makes sense. What about the 1960 case?
Well, in that case, the NLRB wasn't trying to punish anyone. They were just trying to update their procedures.
Right.
You know, make sure they were doing things in the best way possible.
Okay.
And Congress generally gives agencies a lot of authority to do that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, to create their own rules and procedures.
Okay, so it's more about the NLRB, like, fulfilling its broader mission.
Exactly. And, you know, those concurring opinions we talked about.
Right.
They really highlight another important issue, like, how should agencies balance the need to change their policies
okay.
with the fact that people and organizations, they rely on those policies?
Right. They make plans based on them.
Exactly. So, you know, the judges in that second lead-em case, they were saying, hey, we got to be careful here. We got to make sure that agencies aren't just like yanking the rug out from under people.
Right. Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
So we see this idea of like deference to agency expertise, right?
Mm-hmm.
The court in that second lead-em case, they were basically saying, we trust the NLRB to know what they're doing.
Right.
They're the experts in labor law.
Right.
And it's almost like a preview of the Chevron doctrine.
Absolutely.
This idea that courts should defer to agencies when they're interpreting ambiguous statutes.
Right.
Or, you know, making policy decisions within their area of expertise.
Mm, exactly. And that's a really important concept for law students to understand.
Yeah, for sure. So for our listeners, especially the law students out there, what are the key takeaways from these two cases? Like, what should they really be thinking about?
Well, I think the first takeaway is that when it comes to remedies, you know, when an agency's trying to punish someone for violating the law,
right,
they really have to pay close attention to what the statute says.
Right. Stick to the script.
Stick to the script.
Okay.
And if Congress has specifically laid out a penalty,
right,
the agency can't really go beyond that.
Okay. What else?
Well, on the other hand, when an agency is just creating its own rules and procedures,
okay,
courts are going to give them a lot more flexibility.
Right.
Especially if the agency can show that those changes are necessary to achieve the goals of the law.
Right.
So there's this constant tension, right, between wanting agencies to be effective.
Right.
But also wanting to make sure that people can rely on the rules and that those rules are fair.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And, you know, this tension, it comes up in all areas of administrative law.
Yeah.
Not just labor law.
Right. So for anyone out there who's dealing with agencies,
right,
it's something to keep in mind.
Absolutely.
And I think these two lead-em cases, they really illustrate that tension really well.
Yeah, I think they do.
All right, well, that's been a fascinating look at the power of administrative agencies and the NLRB.
Absolutely.
We've seen how courts can both limit that power and grant it broad discretion.
Right.
And ultimately, it comes down to a very complex balancing act.
It does.
So for our listeners, I'd leave you with this thought. Given what we've discussed, when do you think courts should be more willing to defer to an agency's interpretation of the law?
Right.
And when should they stick more closely to the actual text of the statute? It's a question worth pondering as you continue your journey in the legal world. Thanks for listening.
My pleasure.
And we'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.